Thank you. A Tale of Two Kings. January gets its name from the Roman god Janus, who had two faces, one looking back to the old year and one looking forward to the new year. So this is a January message. Let's pray. Speak, Lord, in the stillness while we wait on thee. Hush our hearts to listen in expectancy. Speak, O blessed Master, in this quiet hour. Let us know your presence here and feel your touch of power. Amen. Epiphany celebrates God unveiled as a human in Jesus Christ. Traditionally, there is a focus on the visit of the wise men, since this demonstrates God manifest physically to the Gentiles, the non-Jewish nations. A conflict between two kings dominates this section. A usurper to the throne, Herod, is at front and center stage as the antagonist, with the first negative response to Jesus in the gospel. In contrast, the young Jesus is portrayed as the genuine Davidic king by the words and actions of the wise men, the lords of kings in the ancient world. They utter the first human words in the gospel. Where is the child who has been born king of the Jews or Judeans? In the climax of this section, they are the first humans to worship Jesus. According to Matthew, a rumor was spreading that Jesus' resurrection was a fraud. See chapter 28. If the ending of Jesus' life involved duplicity, what assurance was there that his beginning was not a sham? Matthew directly addresses this concern by asserting that Jesus was a legitimate son of David, as the opening genealogy shows. We know that the Jewish people were longing for the son of David, for the coming king or Messiah promised in the Old Testament. We can see this from some writings called the Psalms of Solomon, which were actually written about 50 BC and not by Solomon. See, O Lord, and raise up for them their king, the son of David, at the time which you chose, O God, to rule over Israel your servant, and gird him with strength to shatter in pieces unrighteous rulers, to purify Jerusalem from nations that trample her down to destruction, in wisdom of righteousness to drive out sinners from their inheritance, to smash the arrogance of the sinner like a potter's vessel, to shatter all their substance with an iron rod, to destroy the lawless nations by the word of his mouth, that by his threat nations flee from his presence, and to reprove sinners with the thoughts of their hearts. This Jewish writing shows how strong was the desire of Israel for the son of David 50 years before Christ. Matthew presents Jesus as the one with the proper credentials to fulfill his people's desire. Lord, restore for them their king, the son of David, to reign over your servant Israel. Unlike Herod, Jesus the infant was no pretender to the throne. How then would he, the son of David, be received? This is the question for all of us. There is a big contrast between the Psalms of Solomon and the Gospel of Matthew. This Jewish writing shows how they wanted not only the son of David, but equally strong, they wanted destruction and ruin for the Gentiles, identified as lawless and sinners. By contrast, Matthew shows that the Gentiles were the first to come and acknowledge the son of David, while the Jewish leadership was quite hostile to his arrival. Matthew 2 is divided into two acts. Act 1 has four scenes, Act 2 has three. The scenes of Act 1. Scene 1 is the plot is the arrival in Jerusalem of the wise men. Note the geographical names Jerusalem in verses 1 and 5 and Bethlehem in verses 1, 5, and 6. Geography is more than a series of place names in Matthew. Where events take place is important, since geography has symbolic significance for Matthew. According to the prophecy, Bethlehem is a place of blessing. On the other hand, Jerusalem is a place of Herod and threat. Both cities involved in the conflict are also in Judea, or the land of Judah. So this is also a tale of two cities. Bethlehem, the insignificant, is a place of blessing and leadership, the home of the true king. The wise men came to Jerusalem because they made the natural assumption that the new king was to be born in the capital city, but this was not God's plan or the way he works. Who were the wise men? The Greek text calls them magi. Later Christian tradition designates the magi as kings, based on Isaiah 60, three in number, and assigns them names, Caspar, Balthasar, and Melchior, and personal characteristics. As we will see later on, they are nameless on purpose. They were actually more important than kings. They were astrologers or scientists, possibly members of a Persian priestly class who advised and counseled kings. Wise men were closely associated with imperial power in antiquity. For example, wise men prophesied the birth of Alexander the Great. Cicero, a Roman senator who lived from 106 to 43 BC, says this about the prophecy of the wise men concerning the birth of Alexander the Great. It is known that wise men cried aloud that the bane and destruction of Asia was born the next night. Also, another writer, Pliny the Elder, who lived from 23 to 79, thus overlapping the life of Jesus, says that through a mixture of medicine, astrology, and religion, the craft of the wise men in the East controls the kings of kings. Thus, they were advisors to kings. Kings relied upon their counsel for everything, and they were even king makers. The fact that wise men came from the distant East and come from the distant East and claim knowledge of the birth of a new king of the Jews is a powerful statement, and one that is quite realistic for the time. Their question, where is the child who has been born king of the Jews, creates the crisis fueling the plot. The repetition of the word king, a term describing a governing and ruling office three times in the opening verses, signals that the desire of Herod to retain power is at the center of the plot. The impact of this question is intensified because these are the first words spoken by humans in the Gospel of Matthew. Notice that the question cuts Herod to the heart. Where is he born king? Jesus is born a king. Herod is only a pretender. Herod was not even Jewish. He was an Edomite, a descendant of Esau. He had tried to legitimize his claim by marrying a Jewish woman so that his children would be half Jewish. Josephus says that Herod went from being a commoner to being appointed king. His father Antipater was a prominent Edomite or Idumean, but he is called a commoner by Josephus because he was not of Davidic descent. Herod received his throne due to the political expediency of Mark Antony of Cleopatra fame and the Roman Senate. Josephus states Antony made up his mind to appoint him king of the Judeans. He convened the Senate, and when Antony came forward and said it would be advantageous to have Herod as king in light of the war against the Parthians, the Senate voted unanimously. Describing Herod's reign, spokespersons for the Judeans told Caesar Augustus he was a king in name, but he incorporated into his own purpose the deadliest traits of every tyranny that ever existed for the destruction of the Judeans. Josephus gives many examples. For example, as Herod lay dying, some Jewish youths tore down a golden eagle Herod had erected on the temple gate in homage to Rome. The perpetrators were caught, and the Jewish officials, quote, because of Herod's ferociousness and fearful lest he savagely wreak vengeance against them, end quote, agreed that the youths be punished. Herod had some of them burned alive. Jesus is the one who is king by right of birth, in contrast to the Idumean usurper who won his kingship by force and guile. The question is further intensified by the wise men's next words, for we observed his star at its rising and have come to pay him homage. Cicero, for example, tells us that wise men had said the sun must be foretelling that Cyrus would reign for 30 years. The English translations have, "We have seen his star in the east." This is confusing and may not be actually correct. According to verse 1, the wise men came from the east. The star they saw was in the west. Either this phrase in the east, which we have in verse 2, means that they were in the east when they first saw the star, or the original Greek could be better interpreted to mean, "We saw his star at its rising," since the Greek word can mean either rising or east. The best explanation of the star that I know is one given by Colin Humphreys, who says it was a comet that appeared between March 9 and April 6 of 5 BC. It was common for comets to be called stars at this time. Josephus says that prior to the destruction of Jerusalem under Titus, a star resembling a sword stood over the city. A comet continued for a year. At the death of Marcus Vipsanius Agrippa in 12 BC, the star, called the comet, for several days hung over the city itself, according to the Roman history of Dio Cassius. As Humphreys explains, the upward tail of the comet would appear to point the head of the comet towards the city. When the Magi left Herod and headed toward Bethlehem, they looked up and saw the comet in front of them with a vertical tail, the head of the comet appearing to stand over Bethlehem. The last part of the wise men's statement is that we have come to pay him homage, to worship him. This signals far more to Matthew's readers than a modern reader brought up in democratic institutions can possibly imagine. In 66 BC, about the time that Matthew published his gospel, 66 AD, Tiridates, king of Armenia, traveled to Nero in Rome to be reinstalled as king. Roman historian Dio Cassius tells us about the event. He says their solemn procession all the way from the Euphrates was like a triumph. His whole retinue, all his royal belongings, followed along with him. Brilliantly decked out cities welcomed them. Upon arrival, Tiridates uttered these words to Nero, "I have come to you, my God. I shall pay homage to you as I also do to Mithras," the Persian god. Matthew is presenting Jesus as a royal figure whose birthday merits extraordinary recognition. Scene 2. The second scene in the plot is King Herod's fearful response to the wise man's question. This fear is real. Herod had several sons from many wives. He lived his life paranoid about which one would try and take the throne from him. Around the same time as the birth of Jesus, fearful of the political ambitions of one of his sons whom he had imprisoned, Josephus tells that although Herod was on the point of death, he ordered some of his bodyguards to bury Antipater in an unmarked grave after they had killed him. There was a joke in Rome. Caesar said he would rather be Herod's pig than his son. These two words in Greek sound the same. He'd rather be Herod's hous than his huios. It was safer. He convenes the religious leadership of Judea to determine where the Messiah is to be born. Matthew ends the first paragraph with a quotation from the Old Testament that combines Micah 5 and 2 Samuel 5, verse 2, adapted slightly to reinforce the royal and Davidic identity of the new child. Scenes 3 and 4. The third scene, this is 7 verses 7 to 12, the third scene portrays the escalating hostility of Herod. Acting dishonorably, he deceives and tricks the Magi, expressing his firm intention to go and pay him homage. The fourth scene, the last part of these verses, verses 9 to 12, describes the joyful, costly, and genuine worship of the wise men. We are reminded of the Queen of Sheba's visit to Solomon. We were just singing about this. "For she also came from the east with gifts of gold and precious spices." But a greater than Solomon is here. In later texts, such as Psalm 72 and Isaiah 60, her gifts become a model of tribute brought to the Messiah. From Isaiah 60, a passage that was also read this morning. Amazing how things fit together with no prior knowledge. The four scenes recorded in the two paragraphs of verses 1 to 12 follow a plot line laid out just like the story of Joseph in 1:18 to 25. There is a crisis in verses 18 to 21, an explanation by quoting the Old Testament in 22 and 23, and the obedient response of Joseph in 24 and 25. Here we have a crisis in verses 1 to 5, a commentary by quoting the Old Testament in verse 6, and a response in verses 7 to 12. Unlike the story in Matthew 1, there is a negative response as well as a positive response. Yet this parallel structure shows that the wise men's obedience to God likens them to Joseph. What is interesting is that in the story told by Matthew, the true worshipers are always coming, going, in short, traveling with no permanent home, while the enemies of God are established and do not travel. Did you notice that? In Matthew's gospel, the godly are always journeying and the wicked are always established. So pay attention to little words like coming and going. In preparation for Act 2, note that in Act 1, Jesus is named once. The wise men are nameless, but Herod is named four times. Herod seems to be in charge of the action. Act 2. Here we see that Jesus is made to relive his people's refuge in an exodus from Egypt. This shows his identification with his people. See, I've summarized what we're going to do. That's the bottom line, if you're wondering what the bottom line is. The second half of chapter 2 provides a dramatic contrast with the first half. We move from a scene where the Magi are bowed in homage and worship of the new king and have offered outrageously expensive gifts to a scene of danger and flight. The disparity between the Magi's response to the child king and Messiah and that of Herod could hardly be more pronounced. While the foreigners worship Jesus, the king in Israel threatens his life. In this way, Matthew confronts us with the possible responses to Jesus or to those proclaiming him. Those who hear can either embrace the message or react with anger and violence. Verses 13 to 23 divides nicely into three paragraphs, 13 to 15, 16 to 18, and 19 to 23, each involving action and movement and ending with a commentary provided by a quotation from the Old Testament. Matthew likes to divide things into threes. Each of these paragraphs is dominated by one main sentence. The main sentence in the first sentence is, "An angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream." Virtually identical to this is the sentence in the center of the last paragraph, "An angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream." No, I think I have that wrong, don't I? One of them is to the Magi. The main sentence in the middle paragraph is, "Herod became exceedingly angry." The pattern with matching first and last paragraphs puts Herod once again at front and center stage as the antagonist in the story. There is, however, a significant difference. In chapter 2, verses 1 to 12, the wise men are only the apparent initiators of the action. The one who is really initiating the action is God. In the extraordinary birth of Jesus, in the placement of the star, in effect, Herod is in mortal conflict with God, who orchestrates the plot off stage. In chapter 2, verses 13 to 23, the power struggle between Herod and God is out in the open. Herod is sandwiched between paragraphs in which the angel of the Lord is the key agent. This is the Herod sandwich. Structurally, an angel of the Lord hems Herod in on both sides. Not once, but twice, we are told succinctly the outcome of this struggle. Herod died. Twice, we're told. Matthew asserts indirectly through this structure what Josephus boldly declares, quote, "Herod's illness grew so much more virulent because God was exacting punishment for his unlawful behavior," end quote. In a series of three scenes, God exercises direct responsibility for protecting the infant from harm. With three commentaries from the Old Testament, Matthew, the gospel writer, explains the significance of each scene. The scenes of the story. The first scene shows movement towards refuge in Egypt, a sanctuary required because the wise men did not comply with Herod's orders after they had left. Here we see that though Herod plans to kill Jesus, Herod's design encounters God's inexorable purpose. as one commentator expressed it. God's sovereign control and providence shines brightly in the midst of baffling evil and genocide. We have to remember this as we think about the parallels between this and Newport. Second scene is focused on massacre. The conflict between the two kings reaches its climax. Herod's malevolent abuse of kingly power is forcefully portrayed by focusing on the overwhelming grief created by the massacre. As in verse 7, Herod is front and center, this time as a mass murderer. This incident sharply contrasts with how the Son of David will rule. In verse 6, the last part of verse 6. The enormity of the slaughter is emphasized. All the male children in Bethlehem and in all that region. The magnitude of Herod's anger is stressed. Exceedingly angry, in contrast to the wise men, exceeding great joy. There are two responses to Jesus, and neither of them is half-hearted. The second commentary is prefaced by the assertion that the massacre was not God's will. Notice, then was fulfilled, verse 17, in contrast to this was to fulfill, verse 15. Here Matthew quotes from Jeremiah 31. We may well ask, what on earth is the connection between this verse in Jeremiah and Herod's slaughter of the innocents? Jeremiah 31 announces the return from exile of northern Israel, which had been conquered and exiled by the Assyrians in 722 BC. The grief and loss and the humiliation and pain of exile will be replaced by comfort, gladness, and joy. At this point, Jeremiah 31 recalls the grief of the exiles. Why does he say, a voice is heard in Ramah, Rachel weeping for her children? Ramah was a city or town about 5 miles north of Jerusalem. According to Jeremiah 40, verse 1, Ramah was the town where all the captives of Israel, Jerusalem were gathered for the march to exile in Babylon. The town of Ramah also belonged to the territory of Benjamin. Rachel's children were Joseph and Benjamin. Ephraim, the largest of the tribes in northern Israel, was descended from Joseph. In Jeremiah 31, the prophet is recalling the exile of northern Israel. Ramah is thus connected with the children of Rachel and with the departure for exile. It is also not far from Rachel's tomb. The method of interpretation here is similar to what we saw in the quotation of Hosea. There is a correspondence between Israel and Messiah. Just as the Jews, amid lamentation and grief, left Ramah to go into exile, so Jesus, amid lamentation and grief, left Bethlehem to go into exile. Moreover, there is a connection between Rachel and Bethlehem because two passages of Scripture say that Rachel's tomb is on the road to Bethlehem. This is true because the tomb of Rachel, not far from Ramah, is also on the road to Bethlehem. Thus, the departure of the Messiah to Egypt recapitulates and repeats the deportation of the people to Babylon and to Assyria. Once again, a pattern established by an event in the past is repeated in the future, and this is a fulfillment of it. The third scene is the journey to Nazareth and anonymous insignificance. Nazareth was a remote town and has the derogatory sense of backwoodsman, i.e., redneck. Notice a parallel between verses 19 and 21 and Exodus 4, which recalls the threat of the king on Moses' life. Once again, Jesus recapitulates the experience and history of his people. The death of Herod is grim reassurance since Archelaus was ruling over Judea in place of his father Herod. Archelaus was just as brutal as his father. He slew 3,000 Judeans at Passover in 4 BC. Just before receiving the kingship from Caesar. Josephus tells us that when Archelaus came to power, he treated the Judeans brutally. The third commentary states that by settling in Nazareth, the word spoken through the prophets was fulfilled. He will be called a Nazarene. This has absolutely stumped laymen and scholars alike, because there is no verse anywhere in the Old Testament which seems to say he will be called a Nazarene. How can we possibly explain this? There seems to be a connection drawn by Matthew between prophecies in Isaiah concerning the Messiah and the name Nazareth. First, when you go to Israel and look at the road signs in Hebrew, you will see that Nazareth is not spelled with a Z or a Z. Now you know what I'm talking about. But with a Sade, a letter that is pronounced T-S. It's not Nazareth, it's Nazareth. Nazareth is connected to the Hebrew word Netzer, which means branch or shoot, in Isaiah 11:1. In 1962, a marble plaque was excavated by archaeologists at Caesarea. It comes from the 3rd and 4th century AD and has the name Nazareth spelled exactly the same way, with the ts and not with the z or z. Greek does not have the ts sound. This is why the Greek New Testament spells it with a z or a z. When Matthew says he will be called a Nazarene, he is saying that he will be called the branch. The term branch leads us to Isaiah, who spoke of the coming one as the branch in these texts. The most well-known one is Isaiah 11:1. There shall come forth a rod from the stem of Jesse, and a branch shall grow out of his roots. Another less well-known is the text in Isaiah 6:13, which speaks of the holy seed in the stump of a felled tree. Here is how we may put these texts together. In the Old Testament, kings were pictured as majestic, stately trees. God's judgment on Israel and upon the wicked kings would result in their tree being cut down. But Isaiah says the holy seed is in the stump. He is predicting that even though the royal house of David is like a cut down tree, there is life in the roots. The root is the root of Jesse, who is the father of David. The stump is the house of David. There is still life in the stump. That life will lead to a shoot or a beautiful branch, and the beautiful branch will overwhelm the stump. In other words, the Messiah, the holy seed, will one day be greater than the house of David. These texts are alluded to in Isaiah 53, when the prophet says that the servant of the Lord will grow up before him like a tender shoot and like a root out of a dry ground. Isaiah says that to make sure that you connect Isaiah 53 with Isaiah 11. Excavations of the old city of Nazareth lead us to conclude that the site was unoccupied from the time of the Assyrian conquest of Galilee, 733 BC, right down to the 2nd century BC. About 100 BC, a small clan of newly returned Jews from Babylon settled there and gave it their family name, Nazareth. These were the Nazareans, a Judean family that proudly identified its Davidic lineage and spoke of itself as the branch clan. Apparently, in strong identification with prophecy, the people in this town had the idea that the Messiah, the branch, would be born from them. Meanwhile, those who knew them scoffed. To other Jewish people in larger, older cities, the Nazareans must have seemed silly in their assumed self-importance. So it's like somebody from Bulla County saying, the coming king is going to come from us. Their little town could not have seemed more distant from the glories of the Davidic kingdom in ancient days. Nathanael, upon hearing from his brother that he had found the Messiah, asked, "Can any good thing come out of Nazareth?" This reflects the attitude of others to the claims of the people from Nazareth. Jesus was to be the branch from Jesse, the family of David, and this great prophecy is that to which Matthew points. The name Nazareth, or better Nazareth, and the title Nazarean, tells us that Jesus was from the branch town. Thus he would be called a branch man. For he, indeed, was the one born to be the branch from the stem of Jesse. This is simply wonderful. As we look out to 2013, the similarities between our times and the times in which Jesus was born seem remarkably close. Does the world seem under the power of mad, angry tyrants are we confronted by baffling evil that we cannot explain, such as the murder of the innocents? Is God in control when bad things happen to good people? Matthew 2 is clearly instructing us that God is the real ruler, and he is accomplishing his plan and purpose in the midst of evil rulers. Just when we think that God's promises are worthless, he is actually fulfilling his word. And he is using those who are willing and obedient to what God has told them. We can be a part of the solution if we are obedient to his word. My dad used to say to me, "Do you come with a problem or are you part of the solution?" We don't need to think that God does not know our situation. We have a king who has completely identified with his people in all of their horrible troubles. Do you see that? Matthew is telling us Jesus is qualified to be your king because he has lived through everything that the people have lived through, step by step. And he has conquered, and then, as then, so now, there are only two responses to this king. Whether Jewish like Joseph or non-Jewish like the Magi, we can give him our allegiance and simple obedience, or like Herod, we can show our anger and hostility. The gospel clearly shows that this is the path of death. Amen.